Welcome to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, the freezer door. The Freezer Door is the latest work of my guest, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who is no stranger to our longtime listeners. In fact, she's been on Out in the Bay three or four times, reading from and, digesting and dissecting for us topics in her previous writings, which include three novels, one memoir, or perhaps a nonfiction novel, we'll get into that later, and five anthologies that she has edited. She's here now to read from and dive into juicy topics in The Freezer Door, published late November 2020. The book gets into gender, sex, trauma, disability, gentrification, conformity, consumerism, queer politics, feminism, impacts of technology, and much more. The Freezer Door has received rave reviews in the New York Times Book Review and Washington Post Book World, and is one of Oprah Magazine's best LGBTQ books of 2020, and a New York Times Editor's Choice. Also, NPR Books named Sycamore's previous novel, Sketch to See, one of the best books of 2018. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So you've selected a couple of passages of The Freezer Door to read for us. Where would you like to start?
I'll start with a passage from about a third of the way into the book.
Great.
Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm fading away. One day I'll wake up and it will just be that gray between day and night, that hovering of everything between. That blinking of eyes into something else, and not the harshness of stomach tension pushing my insides out, my insides in, not the obliteration of the crash, but the softness of the glide. The world we try to make into our own, even as it makes us into the people we don't want to hate, but do. So often we do, and we hope for more, consciously and unconsciously trying to get somewhere that maybe we've never known. Outside, there's a girl gang of shirtless boys jogging in their underwear. Is this the new wave of violent crime that everyone's talking about? A mannequin wearing a brightly colored, dramatically layered, cartoonish outfit labeled street style by Anonymous, in a museum show displaying outfits made by exclusive designers that all cost several thousand dollars each. Was there a time when creativity didn't feel like such a desperate act of self-preservation? One problem with language is that it's still language. I'm wondering if queer will ever become something that holds as much as it harms. Will we ever actualize our rhetoric? If queer is a dream that we don't have to die in order to go on living, what would it mean to create a community of care? And have I ever really witnessed this? This cab driver says, what is it with these people? They think they live in a city, but this is just a big suburb. I like this cab driver. He says there are three guys in the back seat laughing about something. What were they laughing about? They weren't even talking to one another, just sitting with their phones in their hands, texting back and forth. The people here, he says, they don't know how to be people anymore. One problem with narrative is there's always a master. If dreams are literal and we are literally dreaming, then what is a dream? When I was 12, I went to a sleepaway camp in West Virginia where there were a bunch of kids from Florida. There was a hailstorm in August, and they thought it was their first snow. I could never be part of other kids' celebrations anyway.
Thank you. That's Matilda Bernstein Sycamore reading from her book, The Freezer Door. The Freezer Door feels to me a lot like an autobiography, although the format is definitely not standard. Yet when you came out with The End of San Francisco in 2013, called a memoir by the publisher, you said that autobiography is all lies. That's why I write fiction. And that rather than a memoir, quoting you again, maybe The End of San Francisco is a nonfiction novel. So is The Freezer Door also a nonfiction novel or a memoir or a fiction novel?
I would call The Freezer Door a lyric essay because I think it incorporates memoir, criticism, poetry, and fiction all into one form. I would definitely call it nonfiction, though, overall. And like when I was writing The End of San Francisco, I was sort of using the techniques of an experimental novel, but in a nonfiction form. And I think what's really interesting with The Freezer Door is, although I call it a lyric essay, I would say almost every review has called it a memoir. So what's interesting, though, is because there are parts, as you know, in the book where the form itself breaks entirely and it becomes a conversation between an ice cube and an ice cube tray.
And yes. So,
and I'm pretty sure, I mean, I can't be sure because I don't spend as much time in the freezer as one might imagine, but I'm pretty sure those didn't actually happen. But if that can be included within a term like memoir, then I'm all for it. Then let's just call it memoir. So I feel like generally labels of literature leave more to be desired than they create. And so when they're just creating barriers around the form, I think it limits the possibilities of language itself. But if they're going to incorporate all these different forms, then I'll take whatever people want to call it.
Okay, that's good. Speaking of the ice cube and the ice cube tray, I mean, as I was reading this as a kind of an autobiography or a memoir, I found myself thinking like, huh, well, is Matilda the ice cube tray or the ice cube? Or both?
You're not the only person who's asked that.
I'm sure. Well, you don't have to answer it. I can tell you're not going to. So in the section you just read, you mentioned, I think, something like queer holds, wondering if queer holds as much as it harms. And I'm wondering what you mean by that, because a lot of the book you're talking about, like, where do you belong and where do we fit in and where's the connection and kind of a sense of betrayal that you're not getting the, connection that you feel you should. And we all feel we should.
Yeah, I think for me, the dream of queer is a world without borders, a world that ends all hierarchies and creates possibility for everyone on the fringe. So starting with gender and sexual and social and political self-determination for everyone, and involving radical alternatives to both the violence of straight normalcy and the hypocrisy of gay assimilation. And so to me, queer is an alternative to all of that. And I think the rhetoric of queer, though, often camouflages some of the same kinds of behaviors of exclusion that queer, started in order to create alternatives to. So things like racism, classism, homophobia itself, transphobia, body fascism, all of those also exist in queer worlds that emerged as alternatives to that. So in the book, I'm kind of circling around that the dream of queer as this space where we can all create possibilities for self-determination for everyone, and also when that dream fails.
And how do you see that dream failing?
I think it fails when people use the rhetoric of self-determination or accountability or negotiation or transformation in order to still abuse people and get away with it. So like a very sophisticated rhetoric, but not actualizing the potential of that rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. There's a place in the book where you talk about spaces that allowed me to imagine a future were almost always created by queer women who were refusing female socialization. And yet you say that you didn't always feel welcome in feminist spaces either. There's a little thing on page 51, if you don't mind, I'll read it. Without feminism, there would be no queer, but without queer, there would be no feminism, at least not for queers like me. And yet, why do I now feel disembodied in oppositional queer spaces? It's something about the bodies that aren't welcome, including mine. Loyalty to seeing masquerading as critical engagement. Somehow this never fails to demoralize me. The hierarchies are different, but they're still hierarchies. You still there?
Oh, you have a question?
I didn't really ask a question.
I'm like, I agree entirely. That's great writing. I love it.
Part of that reminds me kind of being sort of raised by lesbians in my 20s in Santa Cruz in the late 70s and early 80s. And relating to this in a way in that I don't sometimes feel fully at ease in my body either. Sometimes, or maybe often, just this fear that just being me is sometimes too feminine. But, yet there are these fairy spaces, these fae spaces. And I'm curious if those feel more welcoming to you, or they don't really exist enough?
I guess the question I'm asking in the book is, will my body ever have a home? And so in a way, queer spaces, you know, I've existed in for, I guess, almost 30 years now, and helped to form those spaces, and those spaces have helped to form me. But I feel like more and more, I don't feel like my body is welcome in those spaces. And part of that is the legacy you're talking about, because I think feminism is the politic that formed me. It is what I, you know, the first politic where I could see, you know, what I grew up with, like the hypocrisy of class striving, of gendered violence, all like under the rubric of sort of like liberal progressive. It wasn't progressive then, but even just that idea that like liberalism kind of triumphed. And I could see that violence, and feminism gave me a language for articulating that, and also articulating the ways in which I was always persecuted, you know, as a kid for being a sissy and a faggot, and where I was never allowed into the spaces that were supposed to be the ones that formed me, you know, as someone who was socialized male. And in rejecting all of that violence, feminism was what, you know, enabled me to form myself. But I think queer spaces, which now would disavow kind of 70s feminism, you know, I came of age in the early 90s, born in the 70s, but I think that legacy is still there, the legacy of whose bodies belong and whose bodies don't. And I think that is true across the board in, you know, in normative straight spaces, in dominant gay spaces, and in queer spaces that are allegedly creating those alternatives. And whose bodies are welcome is different. So you mentioned fairy spaces. Fairy spaces, I think, offer an amazing possibility for gender self-determination for people with certain bodies, but not generally for people without those bodies. And the reverse is true, I think, often in radical queer spaces, where the bodies that are welcome are, you know, people who are socialized female and perhaps are challenging and rejecting that. Whereas in fairy spaces, the people who are welcome are the bodies that are socialized male and are perhaps rejecting that. But I think there are hideous hypocrisies in a lot of spaces, and some are less hypocritical than others. And for me, queer spaces have always been the least hypocritical because of the politics themselves. But in terms of the embodiment, I feel like that's the exploration I'm engaging in the book, where I'm feeling like, oh, how do I guess what I'm doing in the book is I'm going into spaces that I already know are corrupt in order to find what isn't. Because I need to figure out a way, if desire is what started this path, you know, toward queerness, then how do I actualize that desire in a way that feels hopeful instead of just throwing me against walls?
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple places in the book where you talk about, I think, I might not be saying it right, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but finally being in your body, or in one place you say, I want my body back. And there's one point kind of early on where you're, I think you're looking at the window and there's some guy smoking out there, and you're saying like, oh, I can do this again or something.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know what was going on before that now you could do this again.
Well, I think actually there's always that feeling, like, you know, so for me, like my sexual life has always taken place mostly in public sexual spaces. So, you know, in parks, in alleys, in back rooms, on beaches. So I feel like for me, the possibility, and I think also that is a queer way of thinking about sexuality, where sexuality doesn't have bounds. And desire is not only about desire for sex, it's about a desire to exist in the world in the fullest way possible. But I think in between those moments of connection, I feel the overwhelming disconnection. And I think
because the sexual things are fleeting, or don't lead to a lasting relationship, or
yes, well, not because they don't lead to a lasting relationship, but because they don't connect to anything else. And mm-hmm. And I think part of that, like the book, in a way, the landscape that the book takes place in, I mean, it is Seattle, but it's also gentrification, and gentrification kind of limits the possibilities for people to connect across borders, across identities, across language. And also alongside that is the sort of trajectory of gay assimilation, where you have, you know, things like marriage and military service and gay cops, gay priests, you know, just take whatever oppressive institution and call it gay, that's progress. But then the possibilities for connection in public space, which for me is the reason to live in a city, those kind of dwindle. And when they do exist, the connection itself is already sort of suffused in a kind of like shame that says this can't go further. This can't be something deep or meaningful, even in the moment. And that's what I encounter more and more. And I feel like that itself is a gentrified mentality. So it's not just the gentrification as displacement, as property, you know, speculation, as, you know, changing cities into destination for consumption rather than creativity or transformation, but it's also the gentrification of desire and love and embodiment itself.
Thank you. I just want to re-ID the show and then we'll talk some more. Maybe you can read another passage. You're listening to Out in the Bay. My guest is Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, author of The Freezer Door, her latest book, which has garnered rave reviews in the New York Times, Washington Post, and Oprah Magazine, among others. In fact, the first print run sold out.
And the second print run is on the way, so feel free to rush out and get the book as soon as you hear this. Would you like me to read another excerpt?
I would love that. Yeah, what do you have in mind?
Perfect. I'm going to read from about two-thirds of, well, it's like in the middle of the book. Suddenly, I'm remembering a public conversation between two great straight white male writers. We've all made the mistake of going to this event at least once, right? After great straight white male writer one reads, it's time for the Q&A. This is where we're supposed to find profound insight. The questions are always the same, so the answers can shine all the more brilliantly. Great straight white male writer two says to great straight white male writer one, who is your ideal audience? And great straight white male writer one says, everyone in my ideal audience is dead. It's hard to imagine anything more damaging to literature than questions about audience. Then again, it's hard to imagine anything more damaging to literature than literature. When people look at me with a mixture of horror and surprise, I think about the way the city of today is just a place for the gawkers to pretend they have a cosmopolitan outlook. Maybe it's a fashion thing, but it's also trauma. Can we ever separate fashion from trauma? I thought I was going to walk through this cemetery, but instead I walk around the wall around the cemetery. So often, there's more protection for the dead than for the living. It's obvious that a gated community is a graveyard. A graveyard has gates to protect the dead from the living. I'm worried that's what the city is becoming. Suburban suspicion repackaged as imagination. Consumption rebranded as creativity. Every new building looks like an office park. And we all know an office park is another kind of graveyard, walling off dreams in search of profit. A graveyard can be a beautiful place to imagine the dead and our lives that remain. To study the stones and names and look at the way that tree pushes those graves to the side, another kind of history. A graveyard can be a respite from the living, even just to watch trees against sky, those clouds growing bolder. But we cannot live in a graveyard. The dream of the city is that you will find everything and everyone you never imagined. Does this possibility even exist anymore?
Thank you. That's Matilda Bernstein Sycamore reading from her book, The Freezer Door. I want to ask you about, you're talking about Seattle. I know you lived in San Francisco for a long time. You mentioned in the book, the Seattle freeze. And I wonder if you could define that a little bit and tell us how different Seattle is from San Francisco or any other city with a lot of gay people in it or queer people in it.
Absolutely. So the Seattle freeze is when you're walking down the street and you see someone up ahead. They're looking at you. They might, it looks kind of like they're interested. You get up close and they look right through you with like, there's like a white picket fence in their eyes. You might even know this person. You might even see someone you know that you're walking close to them and then they turn to look at a wall. They're like, oh, there's a wall. And so in Seattle, people rationalize that kind of behavior by saying, they're like, oh, it's the Nordic heritage. And, but really what it is it's gentrification. It's that gentrified gaze, that mentality of living in a city, but acting like you're in the suburbs. So like avoid any unplanned interaction, you know, anything that isn't, you know, what you expect is not allowed. You know, if someone's not like you, don't even look at them. They don't even deserve to exist. And so I feel like, unfortunately, that gentrified mentality, which does now exist in most of our gentrified cities. So like San Francisco is the place that formed me. And what I've always, is actually the only place I've ever really felt like I was home. And what felt like being home was when I could walk around on the street, like let's say in the Mission or the Tenderloin, and I felt like that shock of recognition, like you're walking down the street and there are other weirdos and outsiders and freaks and dreamers and, you know, wackos, and they see you and they're like, hello, right? And also that sort of possibility for cross-pollination in everyday experience walking around. And I feel like the last time I was in San Francisco, it didn't feel very different from Seattle at all. Like actually for like about 4 or 5 days, the last time I was there, which was 2 years ago, I couldn't even figure out where I was. And I was walking around, like San Francisco, the gentrification in San Francisco is different than in Seattle, where a lot of neighborhoods in Seattle, it looks entirely different. In San Francisco, there's a few neighborhoods, like south of Market, obviously. But like if you're walking around in the Mission, the Castro, you know, whatever, that whole trajectory, you know, the Haight, the buildings are almost entirely the same. Like almost nothing has changed on the outside, but the way people interact is entirely different. Like it's the same thing where, you know, people staring at their phone, you know, like where actually people aren't even out on the streets anymore. I would walk around at like 10 p.m. and there was no one there. And I was like, what is going on? And so I feel like that's that privatization of public space where, you know, to me, like what happens in private, that can happen anywhere. What's different about a city is what happens in public and all of the like surprising interactions we have. But I think cities like New York or San Francisco or Seattle, you know, that used to be filled with especially New York and San Francisco, Seattle less, but still some filled with those possibilities. Now it's all walled off.
And you talk in the book about density and how, you know, these huge buildings are going up to house more people. And affects sort of bringing suburbs into the cities, I think is the way you put it. It doesn't allow people to interact because they're used to their technology, they're used to their cell phones, or is it something about the way they're overworked so they don't have time to, you know, interact on a real basis? What is it?
I think it's really that gated mentality. So it's like people aren't even moving to the city for that dream anymore. Like they're not even coming so that they're like, oh, let me find people who are, you know, totally different from me or someone who's going to shock me or change me. Instead, they're just coming for, you know, either they're going for like, let's say in Seattle, they're coming to work at Amazon. In San Francisco, they're coming to work at Twitter or whatever. You know, they like go to some, you know, wherever they grow up, they go to some college that doesn't change them. They come to a city and they have a job that doesn't change them and they're scared. You know, and they drive into, you know, the parking garage of their mid-rise or high-rise building and they order in their food and maybe they go out on weekends, you know, and get smashed and like gawk at everyone and like, you know, bash some queers or, you know, yell racist slurs and then they go back to their jobs, you know. And so I feel like it's that gated mentality more than anything else.
And here we are in this pandemic. Do you think COVID has changed that? Or you kind of been like, well, people weren't interacting much before. Now we can't, but maybe it doesn't make that much difference. We're all in a little cubbies.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we have an opportunity because now everyone realizes the necessity of public space because it's actually much safer to be outside, you know, and people who before were not really existing outside. Like you see this explosion of jogging, for example. Those are like people who were in gyms before. They weren't outside. I'll see sometimes like in 40 degree weather, people will be having like a little party in the park, you know, which would never have happened before. So people recognize that. And I feel like people are existing more in public space because they have to. And so the possibility is that people can recognize that necessity, you know, and expand it, right? But instead, I see like when someone's having a party in 40 degree weather, I'm like, oh, look, they're having a party. Let me go see what's happening. And they're like, whoa, someone we don't know. I'm like, we're in a park, right? A park is for everyone. You know, we're the same thing with people living on the streets, right? There are more people than ever living on the streets in Seattle, but like it's an absolute explosion. And so people should recognize the need for housing for everyone, right? And also the right to exist in public space. But instead they're like, oh my God, there's someone in a tent on my block, call the cops, you know? And so I feel like the possibility is for people to recognize, or like actually public sex is another great example because it's actually way, way safer now to go to a park if you're going to have sex with someone you don't know, to go to a park and have sex than to go over someone's apartment, right? Like in terms of COVID. So I feel like there is an opportunity for people to re-engage with the possibilities of public space in the urban environment and create more opportunities for everyone. I don't see that, unfortunately, but I do think there is still that opportunity.
Okay, very good. Matilda, thank you so much for sharing your writing and your story with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I always enjoy being on the show.
Now, I just wish it was an hour long because obviously we've got much more to talk about. You've been listening. We barely got into the book. We got to get into it more. Anyway, you've been listening. And I want to tell my listeners right now before I forget, if it's okay with you, I'll put the links to a couple of the video things that you sent me of some of the appearances you had, some readings and Q&As with other writers that are much longer than what we did.
Absolutely.
In case anyone's interested in that. Great. So I'll do that. So look for that on our website. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. My guest has been Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, author of The Freezer Door, which has garnered high praise from the New York Times, Washington Post, and Oprah Magazine, among others. Matilda is also has just finished her sixth anthology, Between Certain Death and a Possible Future, Queer Writing on Growing Up with the AIDS Crisis. Matilda's website is Matilda with two T's, BernsteinSycamore.com. We'll have a link to it on our site, outinthebay.org, as well as links to some of Matilda's other work. We'll also have a link to our 2013 interview with Matilda about her book, The End of San Francisco. That's outinthebay.org, where you can hear the show again and past shows, and please share them with friends. It would also help us if you'd subscribe to our podcast via Stitcher or Apple while you're there and sign up for our email newsletter. We won't cram your inbox, usually just two or three per month, so you won't miss a single episode. That's outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is an independent production. We receive no funds from the radio stations that broadcast us, so please consider a donation if you can't afford it, so that you and others who can't afford it can continue to hear queer voices every week. Also, if you don't have any dough right now, you can help with your talents and skills. It's just three of us part-time now. We have opportunities in front of and behind the mic in many different areas, from audio production and social media to bookkeeping and other help. For more information, check out the post on our website under this week's show, outinthebay.org. Thanks to my co-producers, Kendra Klang and Truk Nguyen. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mee. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for joining us out in the Bay.